Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Tomorrow evening, Tulsa's Council for Holocaust Education will present their 20th annual Interfaith Holocaust Commemoration. Each year, the council tries to bring a different aspect of this tragic history to light, and this year, the commemoration will feature a story that has almost been lost to history. Sigmund Tobias was a Polish-descended Jew living in Berlin in the 1930s. As the violence and discrimination increased in Germany, his family moved to the one place in the world that freely accepted Jews without discrimination, limits, or reservation. Japanese-occupied Shanghai. Yes, it seems hard to believe. While their time in Shanghai was not without hardship, hunger, and disease, and death, a community of European Jews survived the war about as well as anyone in the Japanese-occupied city. Tobias, who's had a long career as an educational psychologist teaching at the City College of New York, Fordham, Columbia, and now as an eminent research professor in education at the University of Albany, tells his family story in the book Strange Haven, A Jewish Childhood in Wartime Shanghai, and will be the featured speaker at the 20th Annual Interfaith Holocaust Commemoration, which takes place tomorrow evening at 7 at Congregation B'nai Emunah. He's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Sigmund Tobias, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
You've told a story of your childhood, which is a different story of displacement during the Holocaust. Your family moved to Shanghai.
Yeah, well, my parents were both born in Poland, and they met and fell in love and married in Berlin, where I was born. And after Kristallnacht, the night of shattered glass, my father recognized that we had to get out of Germany. And the problem Jews had at that time was it wasn't getting out of Germany. It was finding a place that would accept them, to get a visa. He was stateless, as most Jews were, because they were deprived of citizenship by the Nuremberg laws. And so he decided he was going to try to get himself smuggled into Belgium. And he succeeded in crossing the border into Belgium. The Belgian patrol picked him up, sent him back to the Germans, and he was then imprisoned in the Dachau concentration camp. In 1938, you could get out of Dachau if you could leave the country. If you could leave the country, you wouldn't need to get yourself smuggled into Belgium. And so my mother learned, as we made the rounds of various consulates where he was rejected for a visa, that you could go to the Japanese-occupied portion of Shanghai without a visa. And she went and got a ship's ticket for him, went up to the commandant at the Dachau, and he was released on something like, I think, an 18 and 36-hour pass, on the condition that he leave shortly thereafter, and he did. And 6 months later, my mother and I followed him, and we lived in Shanghai throughout the Second World War. My father lived there from 38 to about 50, and I lived there from 39 to 48 when I came to the United States.
And in your book, Strange Haven, you talk a bit about the events leading up to your family deciding to leave Germany, which was obviously a very smart decision in hindsight.
Indeed.
And you talk about it's in many ways a slow burn as things just become worse and worse. And, of course, it culminated in Kristallnacht. What are your memories of that?
I remember we lived on a small street called Metzestrasse. And I remember it was a pleasant street where we had a center strip where there were benches and trees, etc. And one day in the late 30s, 37 or something, people showed up and put signs up on each of the bench. Juden verboten, forbidden to Jews. One bench said that the Jews were permitted, and of course many of the Germans sat there with newspapers as if we'd want to sit there. And that was very frightening. It was also frightening from time to time as we were going from one place to the other to be caught on Nazi parades. And you could see everybody with Sieg Heil with their arms out. And after Kristallnacht, the most frightening things were the vandalism in Jewish stores. You could see them there and saying, dirty Jew, and et cetera, and the windows broken, et cetera. And the most frightening thing to me is the day after Kristallnacht, we walked back to the synagogue where we belonged. It was about 2 blocks away from where we lived. And in the center of the courtyard, we could see that there was a simmering mound of ashes, all the prayer books, and right out of the center was sticking the handles of the Holy Torah scrolls. And I remember thinking to myself, if they can do this, burning the holiest things we have, there's no safety anywhere. And fortunately, my father felt the same way, which set into motion him trying to get into Belgium. And that's how we ended up in Shanghai. Many Jews were unable to leave. I think often it is said that, why didn't they leave? You see, most Jews of Germany, I think almost half the Jews, did leave. The Jews who were caught were Jews in Poland. They didn't know what was in store for them. I believe of the 6 million Jews who were killed in the Shoah, over 3.5 million were in Poland alone, and of course all of the Slavic countries, etc. Most of them were killed then because they had no preparation for it the way Austria and Germany did. And the problem with the Slavic countries was my parents had applied to immigrate into the United States in 1935. But the immigration laws then in place made it difficult for people from Slavic countries to immigrate. Consequently, they were put on a waiting list. And it was only by great fortune that they were able to immigrate to the United States finally in 1950. I came here in 48. And a year later, they followed because what happened was that after the Holocaust, where 6 million Jews were killed, those who survived, they passed something called the Displaced Persons Act, which meant that people could immigrate outside of the usual quota restrictions, those who survived the Holocaust. And to his everlasting credit, Congressman Emanuel Sullivan of Brooklyn added an amendment to a law saying the remaining Jewish refugees in Shanghai were considered displaced persons. Once that happened, my parents were able to immigrate into the United States. And they followed me to this country in 49, where our family was reunited.
You tell the story in the book about those 3 weeks, the toll it took on your father. He said it was the most amazing transformation in the course of 3 weeks in Dachau. He literally...
Indeed. My father was a sort of physically more robust person than I am. He was about 6'2", 6'3", and of a larger frame than I was. And typically, he was a peddler. When he would come home from a successful peddling trip, he would hoist me up on his shoulders and he'd have presents for me, etc. When he came back from Dachau, I saw him coming through the courtyard, and I had trouble recognizing him because they had shaved his hair and he was limping. And it seemed clear that he had shrunk into his clothes. When he came into our apartment with my mother, I suddenly recognized he couldn't pick me up anymore. He didn't have the strength. And in our apartment houses, and many in Germany, in Berlin at that time, you had sort of a tile oven to heat the place. He never got very far away from that oven, spent much of the time with his hands in the oven, because in Dachau, they had basically something like very thin pajamas, and they had to muster for appel, which means,
roll call.
Roll call, thank you, before dawn. It was freezing cold. And he must have lost 20, 25 pounds. And I thought it was 3 weeks, and I wrote in the book 3 weeks because I was so stunned by his appearance. When we went to Dachau about five or six years ago, we walked into Dachau, and they had a little sign saying archives. So I decided to go in, and sure enough, it took him all of 90 seconds to find the record of his imprisonment. He was only there 13 days, and in 13 days, he lost 20 pounds and became a shell of a man. They beat the hell out of him. I mean, that's why he was so bruised and limping, etc. And I recognize in retrospect that in the book I wrote 3 weeks because I was so appalled by what had happened to him, so that I thought it must have taken 3 weeks. And in the slides that I'll show later on today, I have a copy of that record from Dachau showing the exact dates of his imprisonment. And when I looked at the record, I said to myself, gee whiz. I must have been really terrified to, 60 years later, still feel it was 3 weeks rather than 13 days.
Right. Your father made it to Shanghai.
Yes.
And this might be a surprise that this became not a huge haven, but a haven for Jewish refugees.
Indeed.
What was the reason for the Japanese? Because Shanghai was partitioned. There were still the international parts of the city that were controlled by the British, the French. Maybe the Americans had a small section at that time. The Japanese had won the Chinese part in their war with China.
Exactly.
And this was in the Japanese-held areas.
Right.
Why did they want Jewish refugees?
It's bizarre. It happens that there was a war between Japan and Russia in 1904-05.
Yeah.
But actually, the Japanese won the war. And one of the critical figures was the Battle of Port Arthur, which was in 1905. There was an American banker by the name of Jacob Schiff, whose parents had grown up in Russia, and was subject to terrible pogroms. And when he heard about this, and he heard that the Japanese were trying to float a loan in order to finance the war, he arranged a financial package so that the Japanese forces could borrow enough money to finance the war. The Japanese never forgot that. what was interesting about it is that they had a small group, and all of this is based on a doctoral dissertation done at the City University of New York by a man called David Kranzler, who subsequently wrote a book about it. And what was going on is they had a small group of about four or five Japanese officers in their foreign service, the Jewish group. Yeah. And what was fascinating to me as a psychologist, these people had been trained in Germany and had read many of the anti-Semitic tracts, like the Elders of Zion, which said that the Jews kill kids on Passover, etc. Yeah. And they believed that. And at the same time, they also knew about the Jacob Schiff story. They believed that. And it didn't contradict. On the one hand, they saw Jews as the great evil. On the other hand, they saw them as the great financial manipulators. And their idea was that if things would not go well in an impending war in relationship with the United States, they would send an emissary to President Rosenfeld, and they really felt that Roosevelt was Jewish and thought of him as a Rosenfeld, which was, of course, the Nazi propaganda. They would send an emissary and telling them how well the Japanese were treating his co-religionists in Shanghai. And as a matter of fact, we understand that in the middle 40s, an emissary was sent, and he went to Rabbi Stephen Weiss and told him about how well the Jews were being treated. And Rabbi Weiss, not knowing the subtext to this, says, well, it's interesting, and that was that.
So they believed all the negative stereotypes to the point that they felt like you should be cultured, right. you know, you should be catered to.
Yeah, catered to, and at the same time be a little suspicious. Though to their credit, this is not in the book, there's some historical research which emerged after I wrote the book, that in the middle, early 40s, 42, 43, the Germans sent Colonel Josef Meisinger, who was known as the Butcher of Warsaw. It was his idea to burn the Warsaw Ghetto down in order to kill all the Jews. They sent him to Shanghai in order to impose the final solution of the Jewish problem on us. He had three ideas, but his favorite idea was to put all the refugees in a bunch of Chinese junks, tow us out to the Yellow Ocean, and sink us. Fortunately, we didn't know, because of course we would have been terrified. And even more fortunately, the Japanese could not see themselves to do that. What they did do as a sort of compromise with the Germans, who at that time, of course, were their allies, they imposed the law that we had to move into a ghetto, which was sort of the poorest part of Shanghai. And those folks who lived outside of the ghetto simply had to relocate and be given 3 months to do that. The ghetto was fairly primitive. I don't want to go into the detail because it's kind of gruesome, for example, but most of the houses in the ghetto did not have water closets, so which was very unpleasant living in the ghetto. And of course, we had to deal with the malnutrition and diseases which Europeans were not used to. There's a lot of TB, typhoid, cholera, things like that, which Europeans didn't have resistance to, not having been born there. And we filled three cemeteries of the 17,000 to 20,000 Jews who lived in Shanghai, but none of them was as a result of people being shot or killed or gassed. The Japanese simply did not do that.
They pretty much ignored you for the most part? Or was it benign neglect? Or was it a sort of a token effort to appease an ally in Nazi Germany?
I would say they treated us correctly in the sense that they said you had to go into the ghetto. For them, the ghetto ended up being a good idea because the American and British citizens were put in a camp. There were very few of them. And they were in a walled compound, which means the Japanese had to feed them, and even primitive medical care had to be rendered. We were between 17,000 and 20,000 people. So for them, putting us in the ghetto was really a pretty good solution because, A, they didn't have put a wall around us. Why? If they saw a white face like mine in downtown Shanghai, we were not Germans or Russians. They knew we had to be us because all the Brits and all the others were interned in camps. So that was easy for them. And secondly, this way they didn't have to feed us. They didn't have to worry about it. This was our problem. They didn't have to provide medical care. And to their credit, the refugee community got together, and we developed a hospital, we developed a library, and there were schools. We were helped by, in Shanghai, there were two communities of Jews before we arrived. There was the Sephardic community. For example, those people who've been to Shanghai fairly recently may have seen something called the Peace Hotel on Nanjing Lu next to the Bund. When we were there, the Peace Hotel was called the Sassoon Hotel because the Sassoon family was a very prominent family in Shanghai. There was the Kaduri family and others, and they supplied some of the resources. They were generous in donating some funds to help the refugees. There was also a Russian Jewish community who had escaped from the Bolshevik Revolution through Siberia down, and they were helpful to us. And the third thing, there was an American social worker by the name of Laura Margulis, who was able to make a deal with the Japanese, to telling them, look, it's in your interest for us to be able to support these people. And she was able to arrange for money to flow through, I believe, Switzerland. So we had some emergency kitchens. Our major problem during the war was basically malnutrition and coping with these terrible illnesses.
Was that any different than the rest of the city at that point?
No. I think that all things considered, the Japanese probably treated us a little better than they treated the Chinese. But the Chinese, there was this business, I imagine, they had to demonstrate that they were superior Asians to the Chinese. That did not exist to us. So I wouldn't say we were ignored. I would say they were treating us correctly. And they imposed the ghetto in response to, I guess, German pressure, etc. They certainly were not friendly to us. There was a Japanese civil servant by the name of Goyer, Kano Goyer, who was a civil servant. And whenever some people had to work outside of the ghetto, so they had to go to him in order to get a pass, and there were passes for a day, a week, or a month if you could demonstrate that you had regular employment. And he was kind of a short man physically. He was about 4'10 or something like that, less than 5 feet. When a tall refugee went to apply for a pass to leave the ghetto, he gave him a hard time. And Shanghai, pretty much like Tulsa, is hot as hell in the summer. And we have the humidity in Shanghai was much higher. And in the summer, it was 92, 92. It was an average day.
Yeah.
And so apparently a woman went to Goya and applied for a pass, and she was wearing a halter top because it was very hot. You know, there was not only air conditioning, no fans. And he asked her, why are you dressed this way? And she said, well, you know, it's very hot. I said, you're too hot. So he had a bucket of cold water brought in, and he doused her with it. This is the kind of thing he did. He also apparently slapped several refugees who were much taller than he because of that. On the other hand, Goya came to soccer games that we had, and he would send us walking around the ghetto. I know my parents gave me strict orders whenever I saw him not to make any eye contact, but to walk by. But he never accosted anybody on the street, and nobody was shot and nobody was killed. Mm-hmm. Our major loss of life, ironically enough, occurred on July 17, 1945. The American bombardment of Shanghai killed 31 refugees. There was apparently a nondescript building. We didn't know what was in it. It was apparently a major communications, Japanese Army communications center. And they were trying to get that. You know, pinpoint bombing isn't very good today. It certainly wasn't much better during the Second World War. And that's how 31 refugees were killed. The tragedy, of course, is that, six weeks later, the war was over.
Right. My guest today is Sigmund Tobias, currently an eminent research professor in education at the University of Albany at the State University System of New York. He'll be the featured speaker at the 20th Annual Interfaith Holocaust Commemoration. That takes place tomorrow night, Thursday at 7, at Congregation B'nai Amunah. And he'll be talking about his book and his life of Strange Haven, Fleeing the Holocaust to Shanghai, and about the Jewish community that from various parts of Europe settled in Shanghai during the war. Now, one of the, of course, big parts of ghetto life was getting news from Europe.
Yes. Typically, radio is very scarce. And there was one German station broadcast in German. I don't know who funded them. It was funded through Germany. And we began to understand what was going on because they would say the defensive perimeter was reduced in order to be more effective in battling the enemy. We understood immediately that that was a defeat. And there were people with maps, and they would plot. And the defensive perimeter shrank pretty regularly. And then, of course, we heard that the war was over. And the other thing I remember, we had a newspaper in German published by the Jewish community called the Shanghai Jewish Chronicle. And I'll never forget, on one of the pages, there was about maybe 15 lines at the bottom of the page about a new kind of bomb having been dropped in Hiroshima. There was a lot of destruction. And it said something about it using an atomic explosive. We didn't know what that meant particularly, but there were some physicists in our community. They knew immediately what was going on. They said, if that happened, the war can't last very much longer. And of course it didn't. Yeah. And for us, the worst part was, after the war, we had felt we had really survived some brutally difficult times. And, you know, people were sick or malnourishment, maltreated, etc. And then we heard about the Holocaust.
So there was no news of the Holocaust during the war?
and 14 ants.
There's a picture in your book which shows families looking down these huge long lists looking for names.
Looking both for survivors and for news of those killed. Yeah. And of course, most unfortunately, the people who did not survive far outnumbered the people who survived.
What was the reaction in the community to news of the Holocaust? Beyond you were aware of Dachau and you were aware of the concentration camps for political prisoners, Jews, and dissidents.
I think the only thing I can say is that horror rattled through the community. It was just, there wasn't a family that in some way or another wasn't touched by this. And we recognized suddenly, it had one positive effect, sort of. We stopped complaining about our situation because we suddenly recognized that compared to what would have happened to us in Europe, that we were really in paradise. Because no one was really, we didn't have the kind of horrors that befell our relatives in Europe. And that was the positive. But the negative part, of course, is virtually everybody was depressed. I know about my bar mitzvah confirmation occurred shortly after the end of the war in November 1945. And I was happy to immerse myself in studying for it in order to get away from this horror. And so was my mother in many sense. We didn't have bar mitzvahs with the way you do here, hiring halls and this or that. My mother just baked a lot of cakes. And she and my father were happy working on that in order not to have to deal with the other. But to the end of their life, both of them felt the horror of that. And it's something I don't think they've ever gotten over, and frankly, neither have I. I had the sense that two of my cousins, whom I was particularly close to, one of them lived in Dembitz, which is a small town in Poland, and we had maybe 15, 16 cousins in the family. And this kid was by far the brightest of all of us. He could solve riddles more easily than any of us. And the thing I remember is the last time I visited him, it was in 1930, I believe, we had a bad fight. And he was wearing glasses, and I broke his glasses. And then I heard he had not survived. And I had this horrible feeling that the wrong cousin did not survive. How could I have done this? At that time I was not a psychologist. I didn't know about survivor guilt, but I walked around with that for a long, long time. And unfortunately, so did many other Jews. I mean, when you have 6 million, of the 6 million Jews who were killed in the Shoah, it is not widely known, 1.5 million were children under 16. And I had hoped that after that, there would not be such horrors again. And much to my dismay, you have Kosovo and Rwanda and ethnic cleansing, etc. It's as if humanity hasn't learned a lesson somehow or other. And even though I'm not a Freudian, but I have the sense that human beings are descended from animals, and there's still a beast in us. And each of us has to try every day to keep that beast at bay. And some days we succeed more than others, but I hope that we don't get involved at the cleansing and the kind of disasters you hear about refugees, etc. I was a refugee, and I have strong feelings about refugees today.
Unfortunately, there's been no shortage of others since 1945.
Unfortunately not.
Yeah.
It's terrible.
Now, what's maybe interesting to some people is your family stayed for a few years after the war. Was that just because of the huge number of displaced people? There was nowhere to go?
No, there was nowhere to go. My parents, after the war, went back to the American consulate, tried to revive the application, which they had originally filed in 1935. And they were told, it took a month to get the records back from the United States. That, oh, yes, the application was still on file. It would still take many years because the Polish quota was very small. And as I mentioned earlier, the Jews who left were typically German Jews because the German quota for immigration was on the order of around 27,000 a year. The Polish quota was in the hundreds. And consequently, it was very difficult for them to immigrate. And several things happened. After I left, I came to the United States as a regular immigrant because I was born in Germany. And I had no trouble getting a regular visa. My parents decided in 1948, as Mao Zedong was advancing, that it would be horrible for the family to be caught again because after the First World War, the Second World War, they decided it would be safest for me to be in the United States. And they would try to follow, and if they couldn't, I would join them elsewhere. But they felt for safety, it was important for me to be out. and they felt perhaps their chances of immigrating here would be better if I was in this country. And then, as I mentioned, the Congressman Emanuel Sella passed this amendment, which made it possible for them to immigrate. Many Jews went to Israel, and mm-hmm. one of the touching things was that, you know, Israel was founded in 1948, and in 1949 they chartered three small Greek ships, and they sailed up the Huangpu, which was the wharf, mm-hmm. with Israeli flags, and any Jew who wanted to could get on the ship for free, and no one needed a visa, and no one had to worry about a ticket, and many Jews, of course, went to Israel. Some returned to Europe because many of them had property. They had houses, stores, etc., and they wanted to have restitution for those properties. Some went to South America, etc., and then the rest came to the United States. By 1950 or 51, I'm not sure of what, the community was pretty well dissolved. When I returned as a visiting professor to lecture, I was invited to lecture at the Shanghai Institute of Education in 88, there was no evidence of our community at all. Though I met the chancellor of the public schools in Shanghai, and at that time, Shanghai was already about 8 million. Now it's 12, I understand.
Right.
So he had a large school system, and when I met him, I had met him on a visit to the United States, and when I saw him again in Shanghai, as I indicated that I was lecturing at the Shanghai Institute of Education, so on my last night, they had a banquet, and he came to honor me and to say hello again. And I said a little bit about my community. He says, oh, yes, I know all about it. And I said, oh, how do you mean? He said, my office used to be the Shanghai Jewish School. So that's why he had a memory of our community. But in general, the Chinese had very little recollection of it. When I went back to the two houses, one outside of the ghetto, one inside the ghetto where we had lived, the one outside of the ghetto had no recollection of Europeans. As a matter of fact, when I indicated that I lived in this house, I couldn't speak Chinese, but the institute that I visited made a translator available who would walk with me. And the people, when I walked into this house, they wouldn't believe it. And I looked at them and I said, the building next door is now a department store, but it used to be a warehouse. And they look at me and says, you did live here, didn't you? And I said, oh, yes, I did. When I went back to the second house, which was in the ghetto, they already were familiar because someone else who lived in the house had preceded me, so they knew our story. But in general, when I walked through the streets in the ghetto with my translator, he was very impressed because he says, gee, you know this area better than I do. I said, I should. I lived here for 10 years. What was different, of course, was that when I returned, the Chinese had changed all the names. They were different. But I couldn't find the name of the street. But once I was in the street, I had no trouble finding my way.
Well, we look forward to your talk as part of the commemoration.
Thank you.
Thanks for sharing your story, Sig.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Sigmund Tobias is an eminent research professor in education at the University of Albany and will be this featured speaker at the 20th Annual Interfaith Holocaust Commemoration to be held tomorrow evening at 7 o'clock at Congregation B'nai Amuna. He'll be speaking on Strange Haven, Fleeing the Holocaust to Shanghai. If you'd like more information about the commemoration, call the Jewish Federation of Tulsa at 918-495-1100. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.